Hello, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm David Rogowski, and today I will be reading from Outside Magazine. This article is entitled, These Pants Saved My Life. In the early 2000s, word drifted down from the Alaskan wilds about an annual ball that took place to celebrate the life-saving powers of dependable, heavy-duty Carhartt clothing. To put some extra starch in Outside's 25th anniversary issue, we sent Natasha Singer to gather tales of heroic trousers and death-defying coveralls. If you aren't the Carhartt sales representative in Alaska, you hear so many stories about how your durable, mud-brown workwear has saved people's flabby backsides from wolf fangs and grizzly bear bites that after a while, you stop recalling the individual anecdotes. Except during the annual Carhartt Ball in Talkeetna, a winter festival at which fans gather to celebrate another year of survival on the last frontier. One time, says Doug Tweedy, Carhartt's man in Alaska for the past 25 years, there was this walrus attacked a guy tying his boat up to a dock somewhere in the Aleutian chain, who said what saved him were the black, extreme, heavy-duty Carhartts that walrus chompers couldn't bite through. Tweedy tells me this as he busily checks the microphone on stage at the Denali Fairview Inn during a lull in the festivities. Another time, there was this couple pulled over by the side of the Alcan Highway. The grizzly bear mauled the husband who had gotten out of the car, but our coveralls deflected the claws and saved his hide. The Carhartt Ball is not your traditional black tie and strapless gown gala with a sit-down four-course dinner. It started in 1996 after Talkeetna's garbage removal and snowplow magnate Bill Stearns came up with the idea of a Carhartt shindig as an antidote to cabin fever. Although Carhartt rarely advertises, Tweedy agreed to drive up from Anchorage to sponsor the first ball and hand out prizes in the storytelling competition, where winners take home the eponymous outerwear. 6 years later, the annual event has become an occasion for area hunters and fishermen. Carpenters, trappers, mountaineers, whitewater rafters, and back-to-the-land curmudgeons to don their multicolored patch chore coats, kneeless pants, and worn overalls, reduce the strings, and snowmobile into the two-block-long town in the foothills of Mount McKinley to entertain one another with accounts of death-defying animal attacks and engine failures. December 29th, festivities start early at the local VFW Hall, a 60 by 80 foot log cabin, where a catwalk is set up in Talkeetna's Make Like Gazelle Bunchen and strut down it, modeling Carhartt's upcoming spring line. Then the party moves to the Fairview Inn, where everyone crowds around the horseshoe bar wearing spanking new carpenter pants saved just for the occasion, as well as cruddy roadkill Carhartts. Articles of clothing that have blown off the backs of pickup trucks, gotten run over, and been rescued by a passerby. With the perfectly groomed hair of a national newscaster, 51-year-old Tweedy stands out among the guests in a bespoke brown Carhartt tuxedo with black lapels. He is, after all, the master of ceremonies. So that I will blend in, Tweedy has lent me a purple jacket. Brighter hues were recently introduced in the Carhartt line to appeal to rap stars and women. Festooned with battery-operated blinking lights and gigantic hieroglyphics on the back that spells out Carhartt in sequins and glitter. Alaskans buy an estimated 4 times more Carhartt work duds per capita than their compatriots in the lower 48, and their loyalty is not due to just the harsh weather. Up here, hair-curling adventures featuring these sturdy $40 pants and $70 jackets are what distinguish weather-beaten sourdoughs from virgin flatlanders. The company was founded in Michigan in 1889 by traveling salesman Hamilton Carhartt, who started the trend by fashioning railroad uniforms out of surplus Army tent material. Today, his great-grandson Mark Vallade presides over the family-owned, Dearborn-based business, which reportedly grossed $324 million in 2000. Still, what is it about this brand that has made the Carhartt survival story a phenomenon so peculiar to Alaska? Kind of currency swapped in bars late at night, over breakfast in diners, and at the state fair. As epicenter of what could be called a rescue pants epic, Talkeetna's Carhartt Ball seems a good occasion to investigate why this extra-thick, water-repellent, 100% ring-spun duck cloth has become the stuff of frontier fable. In Alaska, you're always getting into extreme situations where everything fails but your Carhartts, Tweedy theorizes. Then, when you get out of the situation, you tell everyone about it. And then, they tell everyone else. All around us at the Fairview Inn, drinking from beer steins at a wooden table, standing by the house rule sign warning, all firearms must be checked with the bartender, villagers are one-upping each other with Carhartt war stories. People call every week with animal stories, chainsaw stories, accident stories, stranded off the road in 70 below zero, skidded hundreds of feet on icy roads on tipped-over motorcycles. I've stopped writing them down, Tweedy says. Then he perks up at the thought of a humdinger. Do you know the one about the Fairbanks policeman who was saved when a assailant's bullet ricocheted off the brass zipper of his Carhartt jacket? As an infamous plaque no longer on display put it, the winter population in Talkeetna was once 378 people and one grouch. These days, it's pushing 800. If you count the tourists, the spring-summer population runs into the tens of thousands, with climbers, campers, and sightseers passing through en route to Denali National Park and Preserve. Carhartts are so prevalent here and the villagers so viscerally loyal to them that visitors sometimes catch Carhartt fever. I've had Californians and Japanese tourists, total strangers, try to buy my Carhartts right off me. Yuppie, scoffed Ted Kuntz, a Talkeetna jack of all trades. When I meet him one morning before the ball for breakfast at the town's latitude 62 degree lodge, they called the years of wear and tear I put in them authentic character. What seems to irritate him is not that interlopers hoped to wheedle him out of his sorry-ass jacket, but that they wanted to appropriate the adventures that came with it. Kuntz, a no-nonsense six-year-old with a stubbly gray beard, sits over his eggs and reindeer sausage and padded black Carhartt bibs, stained with yesterday's cheeseburger juice, last night's spaghetti sauce, aviation gas, engine grease, moose turds, moose innards, and moose blood. He has just pulled an all-nighter at a mile 110 off the nearby Parks Highway, helping adult students learn to carve up abandoned game for a community ed course called Roadkill 101. The difference between formal and informal in Talkeetna is clean Carhartts and dirty ones, he says. The wash ones you wear at church. Ones as cruddy as these, he points at various splotches on his chest and pant legs, you clean, preferably in someone else's washing machine. His varied career, Kuntz tells me, has been a pilot, a tester of Berkeley fly rods, a ski instructor, a forensic photographer, and a green beret. A life such as his is full of Carhartt flashbacks. On one particular memorable night several years ago, as he drove home from Talkeetna, with the mercury hovering at minus 25 degrees, Kunt's 700-pound snowmobile skidded off trail by the side of the road, tumbled down a slope, and flipped on top of him. He credits the thick insulation of his jumpsuit for keeping him alive and warm during the slow, cumbersome process of digging a snow tunnel escape route. Kunt's story exhibits typical Alaskan sang-froid in quick-wittedness and an emergency, as well as frugality. He still has the clothes he wore that night. I just heard about some new high-tech battery-operated parka, he says, but for me, out in the remote, after the batteries ran out, where would I plug it in to recharge it? A birch tree? If you live here, Carhartts are bound to save your life one time or another. Once they do save your life, you're obviously not going to throw them away. That would be like scattering diamonds on the floor. As we head out to the restaurant's parking lot, Kuntz points to his truck. In the bed is his dead Australian shepherd, Jillaroo, wrapped in a beloved Carhartt. I'm about to bury the dog in my oldest Carhartt jacket and build a spirit house over her, he says before driving off. Even in the afterlife, Carhartts are too precious to discard. Where is our Carhartt machete holster, honey? Computer consultant Tom Kluberton asks his girlfriend, Hobbs Butler. At the moment, Butler, a fresh-faced, red-haired 32-year-old, is too busy to help. She's occupied talking about the homemade brown Carhartt tool belt, recycled out of worn-out pants, that she is modeling for me over a pair of newish Carhartt blue jeans. Other people wear through the knees first. I wear through the seat, she tells me. Then I save the waistband in the back pockets. Turn them around, you can get a great tool belt you can hang a hammer on and keep nails in. I've dropped in on Kluberton and Butler at their 1940s hunting lodge over near Talkeetna's railroad tracks because I heard in town that they were a repository of rescue pant epics. Not only because they have spent most of the past decade outside rebuilding their house from the foundation up, but also because they own 12 antic sled dogs. Day to day, these pants will last a lifetime in some place like Oklahoma, Kluberton says. Up here, getting pawed, clawed, and chewed by sled dogs all day long or being dragged along behind them through the thorny devil claw when you fall off the sled, might get a year's wear out of them. He looks down at his raggedy paint-stained trousers, which are 5 months old, but could pass for antique. Kluberton, 50, is tall and loping, with a boyish face and a thick mane of graying hair. He gives me a fast-paced tour of the grounds, breezing past a retaining wall constructed by the Sherpa that our Everest guide neighbor, Todd Burleson, sent over to help. Twice now I've had a chainsaw swing up and catch me on the leg, Kluberton continues. That's why you wear the double knee pants, so the chainsaw cuts off a good long slice of your Carhartt instead of a good long slice of your leg. Even so, you hate to lose a pair of Carhartts. What I do is get a high-temperature automotive silicone gasket sealer and glue the pants back together. When I point out that the silicone gasket sealer is neon orange, he offers a more color-coordinated alternative. You can use duct tape as a temporary fix. Kluberton shows me other pairs of archival trousers he has not repaired because they serve as badges of honor, like the pair with a black-rimmed, burnt-out crotch, the pants that illustrate a kind of infallibility principle. What happened was, while I was driving out of the Costco parking lot in Anchorage, I was futzing with this new mini torch, the kind that will flame a cigar from 11 inches away, which I bought to melt the ice that builds up overnight in my ignition. I dropped the torch in my lap and kept driving until I noticed I was feeling a bit warm. I looked down to find my crotch on fire. Kluberton holds up the gutted pants as evidence. The family jewels were at risk, he says. If I'd been wearing any other kind of pants, I'd have been dead or dying. In trouble. Flambé, even. Instead, I pulled over the side of the road, put myself out, and turned the lighter off. Okay, they're crotchless, but they're still good Carhartts. You can wear them as long as you got boxers underneath. Kluberton goes into a bedroom to change into pants that survive the auto de fe. To prove it, he is right. Those crotchless Carhartts don't look so bad if you like chaps. Fisherman John Farrell has a story that gives new meaning to the term fashion emergency. 50-year-old charter fishing boat captain from Anchor Point, Farrell made national headlines several years ago after his 37-foot aluminum boat, the Irene, capsized dramatically in Cook Inlet, south of Anchorage. I tracked him down by phone from Talkeetna one evening after several folks tell me he is the ultimate protagonist in the definitive Carhartt narrative. Farrell had taken a party out fishing when the shaft connecting the Irene's engine and its transmission broke off, piercing the bolt's hull and flipping it in turbulent 40-degree water. The six passengers and deckhand all clambered onto a four-person life raft. This left no space for the captain, who had to hang on to the hull of his overturned craft. The first Coast Guard helicopter on the scene pelted Farrell with 110-knot rotor winds as it extracted the tourist from the life raft and flew away, leaving him to await the second rescue team. I should have died because I was out there for more than an hour, and generally you're goner in 10 to 15 minutes. Farrell recalls nonchalantly, but I was wearing my double-knee Carhartts, which were so insulated the wind did not penetrate and I didn't get hypothermia. Sure, my arms gave out and turned to silly putty, but the Carhartts protected my bottom half, allowing me to keep afloat by moving my legs. To hear him tell it, and he tells it often since it's his best story, his boat anecdote is less about almost drowning than it is about clothing as miraculous as a shroud of Turin. But behind the clothing trope, the Carhartt survival yarn is a type of Freudian talking cure, a way to get over the aftershock by retelling your life-threatening experiences to others. Bottom line, those pants saved my life, Farrell says proudly. I am the Carhartt poster boy. The Carhartt ball takes place on my last night in Talkeetna, and with all due respect to John Farrell and his pants, there are a lot of poster boys in attendance, not to mention poster girls. MC Doug Tweedy makes a half-hearted attempt to be heard over the raucous crowd standing three deep at the Fairview Inn bar as he introduces a handful of contenders for the survival story. Contest. Well, in typical anarchic Alaskan fashion, the majority of survivors are loudly swapping their bios off stage. Up at the microphone, nurse Colleen Hogan described the time she saved a car crash victim by covering him with a warm jacket. Offering a business survival story, Jam and Jelly maker Laura McDonald recounts how she once lugged 50 gallons of blueberries home in a spare jumpsuit. The contestants are so few that all of them take home Carhartt prizes of hats and t-shirts, and their anticlimactic tales turn out to be so downright mild that I wade into the Fairview's back room, where real cliffhangers are being traded under mounted bull buffalo. I hear some archetypal stories of Alaskan ingenuity, like the one about Donnie Elbert, the mechanic who used his overalls as a frostproof tent one night after his plane crashed in the tundra. And then there's Carl Ober, the quick-thinking river guide who saved his own life after flipping out of his 35-horsepower boat by tying his waxed Carhartt pants into a knot and inflating them into an emergency life vest, all while careening down the Talkeetna River. I head across the room where Teamster Randy Brooks hoists his right leg up on a table and rolls up his pants. He has an ugly 8-inch scar on his right shin. This happened when a birch tree he was cutting for firewood fell, pinning him beneath it and bending his leg at a right angle until the fibula was shattered and the tibia broke through his flesh. Brooks says the reason he's still walking is that the thick insulation of his Carhartts kept him warm, which stopped him from going into shock during the 2 hours it took his two sons to dig him out from beneath the tree, call for help on a nearby radio phone, and put him in an ambulance. This is a true story, backed up by bills and hospital records, Brooks says as his wife Eddie nods. I would have been carving a peg leg for myself out of that birch tree had I not been my Carhartts on, and I still got them. I wear them all the time. As Brooks rhapsodizes about how his pants saved his leg, I realize that whatever permutation of Carhartt yarn you hear, it represents more than an I lived through this epic or psychological coping mechanism. It's an initiation rite and application for citizenship. If you haven't lived through such a tale, it means either you just arrived in Alaska or you have no business being here in the first place. And so, one last story. Even if you're born and bred Alaskan, Carhartts do more than save your hide. They can also save your love life. In 1997, Anjanette Knapp, a 26-year-old ecologist from Sheep Mountain, was trying to impress her musher boyfriend, Zach Steer, 25, when she agreed to dog sled with him through a trailless stretch of backwoods in the Chugach Mountains. It was a bold move. Knapp was new to mushing. Steer would pilot the lead sled, and she would follow him on her home. He instructed her not to let go of the dogs, no matter what. Soon after they started, Knapp accidentally slipped off her sled into deep snow and tumbled. Steer, far ahead and oblivious to his girlfriend's predicament, sped along as she was dragged face down, losing her boot and sock, but never leaving the sled, because the leg of her Carhartt trousers had snagged on the brake pedal. Finally, the dogs, realizing something was amiss, reined themselves in and brought the hell ride to a halt. Needless to say, Steer was impressed by Knapp's endurance. Soon after, he ran the Iditarod with an engagement ring tied to his lead dog's collar and proposed to Knapp at the finish line. Those pants proved not only that Knapp truly belonged in Alaska, but she also belonged to her beloved reader. She married him. Natasha Singer, a former outside correspondent, covers technology for the New York Times, investigating how tech firms and their tools are reshaping childhood, adolescence, and public education. The subject was pants. We talked to Natasha Singer about the far-flung places she explored for Outside, the intrepid, industrious, occasionally nutty souls she met, and the clothes they wore. started as a spillover from a different assignment. In late 1999, GQ sent New York-based writer Natasha Singer to Talkeetna, Alaska to cover a bachelor auction, a party originally put on by the Talkeetna Bachelor Society during the long, dark, cold winter to attract women to the remote town at the foot of Denali. After the trip, she contacted Outside's executive editor at the time, Jay Stowe, with a brief but enticing pitch that went something like, "I heard about this local fair called the Carhartt Ball, where weathered Alaskans swap wild stories of survival, angry Wallace attacks, and advertise and advertent dips in icy rivers, accidental immolation, all thanks to their Carhartts. Interested?" She had us at angry Wallace attacks. The vision of hardy frontier folks stepping up to the mic to regale friends and neighbors with gonzo tales of death-defying rescue by outerwear was too good to pass up. So we sent Singer back to Talkeetna to cover the annual event, which is still going strong despite a COVID-19 interruption in 2020. At the time, the ball consisted of locals modeling Carhartt's spring line at the VFW hall, followed by a storytelling competition at a nearby bar. Not only was it sponsored by Carhartt, but the clothing manufacturer's main man in Anchorage served as the event's MC, decked out in a bespoke brown Carhartt tuxedo with black lapels, Natch. Singer's story ran in the magazine's 25th anniversary issue in October 2002, under the rubric Revelries of the Rustics. This wasn't the first time Singer had traveled to a remote locale for Outside. It wouldn't be the last. As a roving correspondent for the magazine in early 2000, she documented a cockeyed attempt to return Keiko, the killer whale star of Free Willy, to the sea off the coast of Iceland, hopped a ride on U.S. Coast Guard cutter, attempting to break through ice-choked Northwest Passage, and slogged through the jungles of Thailand in pursuit of a group of wild aid activists trying to halt an illicit trade in endangered species. "Oh my God," she said, recalling that reporting trip, "did I tell you about the anti-leech socks?" These days, she writes about technology and education for the New York Times business section. Stowe recently caught up with Singer about her globetrotting experience. Outside, "Maybe I shouldn't say this since I wrote it, but your story ran under my favorite headline. These pants saved my life. Straight to the point, prominently employs the word pants and has the added value of being true. How did you discover the Carhartt ball?" Singer, "There's a saying about Alaska. If you're a woman looking for a guy, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. In Talkeetna especially, the odds are better, but the goods are odder. I had been sent there to do a story on the bachelor auction, and I started to hear these really interesting stories, episodes where people got into trouble and their Carhartts, miraculously, like the Shroud of Turin, seemed to have magical properties that were healing or life-saving. People were telling real stories like, 'This tree fell on me, but I was wearing my double-knee Carhartt pants, so I didn't go get hypothermia. I survived for 3 hours. This was normal discourse, and the pants were the common denominator.' I've always thought that there's a reason people go to live in Alaska, and it's mainly to get away from the rest of us in Lower 48. We all have tribes, and we all have things that distinguish who gets in the tribe and who doesn't. The Carhartt epic is a way of saying, okay, we have a shared experience, even if yours is, you know, dropping your lighter on your pants and flaming out the crotch. It's a common thread that binds people and demonstrates their Alaskan-ness." Was it easy to get people talking? One of the things I love about being a reporter is when people share their passion for the things that matter to them, whether that's expertise about the bearded iris or how to butcher a roadkill deer. So even in a standoffish places, I find that if you're authentically interested, people will show you something, then it will be super cool. And you're naturally going to say, "Oh, that's amazing." And they'll say, "Well, you want to see the next thing?" And then it's 3 hours later and they've shown you every single pair of Carhartt pants in their closet. At one point, you meet Ted Kuntz, a jack-of-all-trades in Talkeetna, and over eggs and reindeer sausage, he scoffs at the tourists who try to buy his Carhartts right off him. He says, "They call the years of wear and tear I put in them authentic character." He's very perceptive, like, these Alaskans know they're being ogled just as much as the grizzlies. Essentially, he was saying, these are real. The tourists want the veneer of reality, but they don't want to live our lived experience, which it's tough to live in Alaska, right? It's cold and the winters are harsh. And it's still our frontier. That is, if you don't live in downtown Anchorage, I get what he was saying. People want frontier cred without actually putting the years into the effort. How did you get your start? I studied Russian in college and wanted to go off to Russia. Even though I was not fluent, I ended up going to Moscow and staying for a decade. This was in the 1990s. The Soviet Union had just collapsed and it was inexpensive to travel because everything was in rubles. So I was going all over. I was covering human rights for The Forward, business for USA Today, and fashion for Vogue. It was this crazy decade, you know. If it's Monday, this must be Siberia. If it's Tuesday, I'm doing a segment on Good Morning Kazakhstan. Then I was asked to help start Vogue Russia. I'm grateful I was able to cover those former Soviet republics, but at some point, you have to either decide to stay forever or go home. Then I went back to New York, and nobody wanted me to write about New York, so I was Miss Strange Places. One of your first Outside stories was about an American billionaire attempting to release Keiko back into the wild, and another you hitched a ride on U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker as it busted through the Northwest Passage, a trip made possible by climate change. When you think of those pieces along with the Carhartt ball, the range is impressive, ridiculous, sublime, daunting. You are able to do it all. The various stories I did with Outside had adventure quality, but they also had a quality of observation. That's what we now call lurking, right? Watching what's happening and then explaining it. I felt lucky to be in that position. We have this romantic notion of icebergs, but the Northwest Passage is just miles and miles of bumpy, ugly ice. As I wrote, unlike freshwater icebergs, sea ice is not romantic. It's neither majestic nor sewing. It does not give off that otherworldly spectral of glow of pure whiteness born of glacial snow. Its verticality does not threaten ocean liners with a predatory, awe-inspiring loom. It's not prehistoric in origin. Quite the contrary, most sea ice is younger than a decade. It is flat and flawed. It's often pockmarked, dirty with algae, and lumpy with protruding hummocks. I love that paragraph, and I still don't know how I got away with writing it or how anybody signed off on it. I'm working at the Times now. I don't get to write paragraphs like that very often. So the other thing I'm grateful for is that Outside pushed me to write at the top of my range. I was very happy to sign off on that. We still have to talk about my friends from high school who wrote a letter to the editor Outside. She was like, I read the story by your writer, Natasha Singer. I went to school with a Natasha Singer, and I'm wondering if it's the same person. Because in high school, we didn't think of her as an outside girl. We thought of her as an inside girl, as in, inside the house. I'm glad we were able to help you defy the opinions of your former classmates. You've been able to report on a lot of amazing things that go on in the world. It's like when we said that those pants saved Alaskan lives. In a way, Outside changed my life. To be able to write those stories, report them, and meet all those people and get to do all the things, real stories, where there were people telling us real things that real mattered, that really mattered. It was a gift to be able to do that. And that was an interview by Jay Stowe of Natasha Singer, who served at, and Jay Stowe served as a features editor and executive editor at Outside from 1999 to 2004. He was an editor-in-chief of Cincinnati Magazine from 2004 to 2017. Currently, he's a senior editor at the content agency Fitch, Inc. And next up, we have The Giving Trees. Heritage-grown food is a delicious testament of time by Amanda M. Fison. At the end of August, I get the call. The apricots are ready, my mom says excitedly. I grab a few buckets, jump in my car, and drive the 100 or so miles from my home in Dillon, Colorado, to her place in Carbondale. Pile into her Subaru and wind a bit higher into the slopes above the Roaring Fork Valley. We wave as we pass our friend's house and park below their orchard, a century-old stand of apricot trees that sit at 6,500 feet. The 50 trees here are old, and time has gnarled their branches. A weathered wooden ladder reaches into the canopy. The perfumed air reminds us of the jam-making and bacon that will, happily, occupy our time in the weeks ahead. These days, grocery stores sell firm apricots the size of golf balls, but the soft, ripe fruit in these trees are different, are the diameter of a quarter. It takes a while to fill a bucket, but the intense flavors are worth it. Other scavengers are around, birds, deer, even bears, and we give them plenty of space. This orchard, which contains several apricot varieties, is believed to date back to 1915, and being here makes me think about the people who have planted it and what the trees have endured. Surely there have been periods of extended drought and extreme cold, and yet, year after year, they continue to bring forth treasures. Fruit trees watch several generations go by, says Michael Thompson, who along with Jerome Ostentowski co-founded an organization called the Heritage Fruit Tree Project, a nonprofit that maps and catalogs ancient specimens like these all over the valley. Great old trees are not unique to Colorado or the West, of course. They dot the nation, languishing in plain sight in forgotten corners of cities and towns and across rolling farmland. But in recent years, spurred by a renewed interest in things with rich stories and heritage behind them, there's been a movement not just to save old trees, but to propagate them for the future. In New York City, Sam Van Aken, an artist-turned-farmer, planted a permanent heirloom exhibition on Governor's Island called Open Orchard. The public site opened in 2022. The 102 specimens it comprises are grafted from trees, apricots, apples, pears, persimmons, cherries, and others that once thrived across the city's five boroughs. In total, they represent about 400 years of local agriculture. Although most Americans get by with the fruit they find piled in grocery bins that represent only the tiniest slice of what once freely bloomed, take the apple. Our commercial homogenized food system promotes varieties like the crisp, boring Fuji and Granny Smith because they are easily grown, universally accepted, and hardy enough to transport and store. There were once thousands of cultivated apple varieties, and now we're down to hundreds, said Vanessa Harmony, a tree propagator and the owner of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, which works in tandem with the Heritage Fruit Tree Project. There are so many delicious fruits that could be lost if they're not found, she says. That's the role of organizations like Regis Tree of North America, Washington State University's My Fruit Tree, which works only with apples and regional entities like Thompson's Heritage Fruit Tree Project. Indexing each heirloom type, location, approximate age, fruit characteristics, and site history culminates in a written log and map of agricultural diversity. This information helps when experts are grafting clones to ensure that varieties aren't lost to time. Like Open Orchard in New York, Harmony Thompson Ostentowski have had a hand in creating a research site filled with fruit trees. The parcel, established in 2020, sits within an old orchard in Emma, Colorado, outside Basalt. It's open to the public and will eventually feature informational placards so visitors know what they're looking at. Harmony helps maintain the old trees and the newly planted clones gathered from around the valley. It's become a living library for me, she says. Observing the trees through the seasons means Harmony can identify desired qualities, whether it's the best tasting fruit, tree hardiness, or something else. She can also send leaf samples out for genetic testing to determine exactly what kind of tree she's dealing with. Sometimes that information yields an entirely new variety, or rather one so old that no one around today knew about it. Thompson enlisted Harmony's help with her favorite, a grand old apple tree he affectionately calls Mo. It was planted in 1910 and produces what Thompson considers the best apple he has ever found for pie making. In recent years, this magnificent tree has suffered from blight. Even with thoughtful pruning, its future is in question. Harmony has already grafted multiple clones from the healthy parts of the tree, those mini Mo's, two of which are planted in Thompson's daughter's backyard in Oregon, and two of which are doing well at Harmony's nursery, are the next generation. The tree will live on, he says. As for the apricots that leave my mom's and my hands sticky with juice, our friends have largely let nature take its course. In the 30th years they have owned the property, Susie Ellison says they've had the orchard pruned only a couple of times. The trees, she tells me, seem to like being left alone. You don't want to fuss with them too much, she explains, adding that they've been cataloged by the Heritage Fruit Tree Project. We gather our buckets and load them into the car. As soon as we close the doors, we're enveloped by the thick and heady scent of apricots. We wave again as we pass the house and drive straight to my mom's. There's jam to be made. This is by Amanda Faison, a writer and editor based in Colorado, who's working on her first cookbook. You have been listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I've been reading from Outside Magazine. My name is Dave Rogowski. Thank you for listening.